This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. Our guest this episode is Henry Hartevelt, a well-known travel industry analyst and founder and president of Atmosphere Research Group. We talk about the impacts of COVID-19 and the 737 MAX on the travel industry. In the news, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is requiring a negative COVID-19 test for all air passengers entering the United States. Airlines are benefiting from the COVID-19 relief package. The middle seat can be booked on some airlines, but not others. We also see air cargo is booming. On the military front, the F-35 qualifications for an Italian aircraft carrier are set to begin. And Australia orders the Apache helicopter. Also, many aviation events are postponed due to COVID-19 concerns. All that and more is coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 637 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me this episode is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert.
Hello, everyone. Looking forward to a great show because one of my favorite guests is on.
We do have a fantastic guest, but first I have to introduce Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and of course, he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
Oh, you know, I just love it when David calls me his favorite guest. I mean, I think that is so, that is just wonderful. Oh, wait, no, I'm the co-host.
That's right. Well, we have to
you want to be demoted? That's fine.
All right, well, we have to introduce our guest. That's Henry Hartevelt. Henry's a well-known travel industry analyst. He's founder and president of Atmosphere Research Group. And of course, Henry has an extensive background in marketing, planning, distribution, and strategy. And he was head of Forrester Research's Global Travel Research Practice. Henry launched Atmosphere Research in September 2011, and that firm helps travel industry clients understand emerging trends and opportunities. And that's in areas like brand strategy and distribution, product development and retailing, customer experience, loyalty marketing, and digital commerce and technologies. And he's got worldwide clients. They include airlines, lodging firms, cruise lines, car rental agencies, a lot of different folks that are in the travel space. So, Henry, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be back.
It has been quite a while. I didn't check, but it might have been a couple of years, I think. But it's really good to have you here because Henry, of course, has really insightful viewpoints or some insights, let's say, into the airlines and the travel industry, and particularly in these excessively turbulent times. So we're going to really benefit by having Henry on the show this episode. So why don't we get started right away with some of the aviation news from the past week? Are you guys ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
All right, from CNN, we see CDC to require all air travelers in the United States to show negative coronavirus test. Max, this is something coming out of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
It is. And, you know, there's another aspect to this, which is of interest to general aviation pilots. This applies to all aircraft coming into the U.S., even a Cessna 172. You're no longer allowed to transit from, you know, other countries, Canada, Mexico, the Bahamas are probably the most common places, unless you have this test. And as I recall, it needs to be done 3 days ahead of time.
That's right. 3 days before departure to the United States, and air passengers have to get a viral test. Also provide written documentation of their laboratory test result. It can be paper documentation or an electronic copy. And that has to be provided to the airline, or without that, you have to provide documentation that you have recovered from COVID-19. Now, airlines have some requirements here. They must confirm the negative test result for all passengers or documentation of recovery, before the passenger boards. And if the passenger doesn't have that documentation of a negative test or of recovery, then the airline has to refuse or deny boarding for that passenger. Henry, do you think this is going to be excessively disruptive? Is this going to operate smoothly, do you think?
Of course it's not going to operate smoothly. Yes, there will be some disruption. So the intention of the CDC is certainly a good one. With the virus as strong as it is all around the world, and with at least now two known mutations of the virus, possibly three, one in the UK, a stronger and potentially more powerful mutation from South Africa, and now possibly a third mutation that's emerged from Brazil, we have to be diligent about making sure we take whatever steps we can to reduce the potential for someone bringing the virus back to the country. So this, however, now forces a traveler, if it's an American traveling abroad, to scramble to get a test. And so if you've already planned a trip, let's say, and you're going to be away on the 26th or after the 26th when this goes into effect, you have to figure out, where am I going to get tested? Will your hotel have it? If you're staying at Airbnb or other lodging or with friends, where can you get this? Will it be covered by your insurance, and so on? And as you said, the test has to be conducted no more than 72 hours before you board your flight home. So that also means not only do you have to get the test, but you have to get the results back, or the airline will deny you boarding. So there's going to be at least short-term disruption. And of course, for anyone who had planned to come to the U.S. where they're allowed to do so, that adds another wrinkle. And just to throw yet another wrinkle into this whole thing, this afternoon, President Trump announced that effective January 26th, the same day this new testing requirement goes into effect, the government would allow travelers from the UK, other European countries, and Brazil to come into effect. But no sooner did that announcement get made by the White House — it was initially broken, the story was broken by Reuters — the White House confirmed it. And within moments, it seems, the Biden administration said, not so fast, we're not going to do that. And they intend to reinstate the restriction on people from Brazil, from the UK, from Europe, coming to the US for now. So if you can figure all of that out, you get a prize.
You have 5 days to sneak in here, it sounds like.
Yeah, yes. And this just applies to air travel? This doesn't apply to other modes of transportation?
That's a really good question. So Max made a really good point that it applies to general aviation and executive aviation. I believe that it does apply to land border crossings as well. But, you know, I'm not sure the volume of people who are coming beyond, for example, Mexico, and essentially the borders between the U.S. and Canada are closed for anything but essential travel.
Right, right. So this really could impact a lot of people and add a lot of confusion. The airlines themselves have to, get prepared for this as well.
Airlines and airports. And what I've already heard from hotels are that some are trying to arrange now to get testing conducted on site. One general manager said he wants to make this testing like breakfast, something that is available and something that his guests won't have to think about. Now, that's a general manager of a 5-star luxury resort in the Caribbean. And so they can afford, figuratively and literally, to make sure they get this. But remember, if you are coming from a country where testing may be more limited, and if you're not staying at a 5-star hotel, you may have to scramble as the traveler. So if you are planning to travel abroad, if you're an American, do your homework. And if you are coming to visit the U.S. from abroad, again, do your research to make sure you can get the test conducted when and where you need it.
There's one other wrinkle as well. We've heard of people who have been quarantined once they arrive in a foreign country. So, and some of these people have been arrested when they leave the hotel for, you know, not as well, for any reason. I don't think there is a essential reason for leaving your quarantine. So you could be in a catch-22 where you have to go get a test, but you can't leave your hotel. So people might have to hang out longer than they expect until their quarantine expires in order to get the test, in order to come home.
So, Max, my understanding for that is that there aren't going to be too many people who would be subject to that, because if you think about it, you have to have a test administered within 72 hours of boarding your flight. Even among AvGeeks right now, there aren't too many people who are going to be flying abroad and then turning right around and coming back home. But there are countries where quarantines are strictly imposed. For example, Australia, where more than two dozen players for the Australia Open tennis match have been quarantined in their rooms. But they're going to be there for a while. However, my understanding is that, let's say you were planning to go somewhere and you got exemption to leave your room. You were only going to be there for a week or something. This would be considered essential. I believe there would be a carve out to let you go get the test. There are also some companies that are creating, if you will, at-home types of tests that you can take that are, for lack of a better analogy, similar to a pregnancy test. It's not conducted the same way. I think it uses saliva, but it does provide the proof that would be needed. And there are, they would, the results would be accepted by airlines and airports. But again, you know, there's a lot of, there are a lot of moving parts here. There's a lot of confusion. You know, and it's just makes a tough time to travel that much more difficult.
Yeah, and it may be too soon to say what kind of a effect this will have on passenger volume, if it'll have a depressing effect on travel, because, you know, some people might just say, well, this is too difficult, too confusing, too uncertain, and so I'm just not going to travel.
Right. There's been a small amount of that, that according to airlines that I've spoken with and some travel agents, not too much. But there have been some people who've said, you know what, I want to rebook. I'm not going to take a chance of going to wherever I was supposed to go. I'll travel domestically, or I'll postpone my trip where they can do so. The other thing that's not factored for right now is people who are vaccinated. If you're vaccinated, if you've been lucky enough to get the vaccine, and we know only a small number of people have been, would that suffice, or do you still have to have the vaccine and the test? And right now, the policy is you still have to have the test.
Right. I think as we record this, it's not certain whether the vaccine prevents you from passing it along to other people, I believe.
So we've all become armchair epidemiologists, right, and scientists in the past 10 months. You know, I'm the kid who in biology class passed out trying to dissect a frog. So, you know, clearly, you know, not only was I not going to become the doctor that every Jewish parent hopes their children will be, but, you know, science was pretty much ruled out. But what I do understand is that the vaccine prevents us from getting sick. It doesn't prevent us yet, or not all the vaccines may prevent us from transmitting the virus. Just like, if you will, a flu shot. The flu shot reduces our chance of contracting the virus, but it doesn't keep us from spreading it. So to your point, again, this is emerging. It's new. It's going to change. But you're right. And that's why, by the way, we should all be prepared, even once we get a critical mass of people vaccinated, to expect to continue to have to wear masks in public spaces like airports and on board a plane.
Yeah, I think, go ahead, David.
I was going to ask Henry a follow-up question, say, do we know how this is going to affect crews, meaning like pilots and flight attendants?
That is a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Presumably, they would have to have a proof, you know, they would have to have some kind of negative test because they're leaving and they are returning right away. But I don't know if there are exemptions to this for airline crew.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, David. I'm sure they're wondering this themselves, what the answer is. In the recently passed COVID-19 relief package, there's $15 billion that's been provided for airlines for salaries through the end of March. And we see that Southwest Airlines has canceled the furloughs that it was planning. United and American say that they'll bring back thousands of the furloughed employees. But is travel likely to rebound? Are we on a trajectory where we see that? And Henry, I know that you've done some research looking at what that might look like.
Yeah, Max, what I would say is that we shouldn't use phrases like rebound. Mm. We expect, as do organizations such as IATA and others, expect that 2021 will be the year when recovery begins. Now, we currently believe that if we can get vaccines distributed and into the arms of enough people, that at least in the U.S., we're on track. We should be on track to see minimum of 50% recovery. In other words, 50% of 2019 pre-COVID levels of traffic and revenue return to the airline industry this year. It will be led by leisure travelers. Business travel will be very limited through this year. We expect it won't get going much before the second half of the year. But because leisure travel is completely discretionary, and hopefully we will start to see borders reopen, things like these restrictions and quarantines be reduced or even eliminated, we should see the start of recovery. Currently, we at Atmosphere believe it is going to take roughly 3 years for us to get back to full recovery. That's based on research we conducted in 2020 with airlines, and they estimated 3.1 years from the time vaccines become widely available in their home markets. So that figuring that the vaccine would become available sometime in 2021, that puts us at 2024. Now, recovery may be faster. I certainly hope it will be. I think we all do. But I don't think we're going to get back to 100% much before 2023 at the earliest. Domestic airlines in the U.S. or airlines whose route networks are primarily focused on North America will have a better chance of a faster recovery than global carriers such as American, Delta, and United. While the budget airlines such as Spirit and Frontier or Allegiant and airlines like Hawaiian and JetBlue that are more reliant on leisure travelers should show a faster pace of recovery. Let's also remember that you've got some of the largest airlines that have the basic economy deep discount prices, which they will use to attract as many passengers as they can. So the recovery is not going to be an even one. It's going to be brutal. The good news for consumers, I think we'll see a lot of price competition out there. But we need to anticipate that it's likely going to take roughly 3 years for the industry to fully, fully recover.
And probably that recovery would occur at different rates for different segments of the travel industry. Do you think that's I'm thinking the airlines might sort of lag some of the other aspects like hotels.
So a really good example of that, and I agree with you, is lodging. Okay. You know, we may not want to fly or be able to fly everywhere or simply feel it's still too expensive or too risky, but we'll drive somewhere because we can go in our cars. And so what's interesting is some hotels and organizations like Airbnb and VRBO have seen some strong recovery, at least with regional travel. We've seen people drive distances in the U.S. over the summer that we hadn't seen in years. It's the old road trip like a lot of people used to do with their families when flying was much more expensive than it is now. So lodging may recover slightly faster than air. Conventions will be slower to recover. I think the cruise industry is going to take a long time to get back to 100%. But I think airlines, like I said, 3 years or so to recover.
In terms of the airlines, there has been quite a bit of press, studies, reports about the air quality in airliners. People, I think the general public, let's say, sort of have this impression or did that, you know, it's a petri dish, you know, it's a closed tube and it must be a real toxic environment in terms of catching the virus. Are you seeing any indication that people are starting to, you know, accept the notion that actually the air in an airliner might actually be pretty clean?
Yeah, I mean, what's really interesting is in some focus groups that we've done, there is now recognition among travelers that the air on the plane is clean. And what's very interesting is that as the airlines have invested in the physical elements of cleaning, so, you know, wiping down surfaces, cleaning out those seat back pockets, vacuuming more, everything else that they are doing, you know, the plane is looking and even smelling cleaner, or at least maybe it's smelling like bleach or disinfectant or whatever it is. And, you know, what I remember when I was working at one airline is, you know, the president of the airline said, look, if the, you know, passenger sees a clean tray table, they think the engines are new too. So, you know, the investment that airlines are making in the physical cleaning of their planes, I think, are benefiting them. The air on the plane, these HEPA filters that have been on modern jets for years, has certainly helped. But we all know or have heard stories of people getting sick on planes. I think wearing the masks help. It's a layered approach, figuratively and literally. Wearing masks help. Running the air circulation at, you know, a higher speed helps. Fewer people on the planes help. The deeper and more thorough and more frequent cleaning helps. All of that contributes to this. What's interesting is people say, look, I feel okay on the plane or even comfortable on the plane, but it's everything else that concerns me. Getting, you know, if I'm not in my own car, getting to the airport, getting through the airport, making a connection. And then depending on where I am, people who are at the hotel or on the street or whatever else. So again, you know, it just all depends. But I think that the airlines and the aircraft makers have certainly worked hard and are starting to get recognition that the air quality on the plane is cleaner and in fact, one of the safest places from a health standpoint to be.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's not where it started. You know, that perception is not where it started, I think. So it's interesting to see some movement there. Another part of the onboard perception is the middle seat. And different airlines seem to be taking little different strategies in terms of, you know, are they going to book the or make the middle seats available for booking or not?
Right. And right now in the U.S., Delta Airlines is the only airline that is still blocking middle seats on most of its flights. The JetBlue and Southwest, which were the last two holdouts, ended their blocked middle seat policies at the beginning of January after the New Year's holiday. American and Delta last year went back to selling middle seats fairly early on. Hawaiian Airlines isn't blocking seats. The truth is this. First, most flights are, I shouldn't say most, roughly half, maybe more of the flights out there are still operating at below 50% load factors. So chances are you've still got a good chance of getting an empty middle seat and on some flights an empty row. But what's interesting is in its earnings call last week, Delta said they're getting a very healthy revenue premium. And if I recall correctly, one of the Wall Street analysts estimated it's roughly 11% when you adjust for Delta's sellable capacity versus the capacity of those of its competitors. That indicates that people are willing to pay more for Delta's product. Delta also said that they're getting good trade up to their premium products, which include extra legroom seats, premium economy on its international widebody flights, and business or first class, depending on the premium cabin configuration there. So, you know, people have money, they will spend it where they feel it's better. And so it becomes a game of, do you want to be what's perceived to be premium, or do you want to be more mass market? And I'm going to be very curious to see what the financial results are for American, for JetBlue, for United, for Southwest, and for Alaska, which compete to some degree with Delta on many of their routes in the mainland U.S.
While passenger traffic, of course, is way down, we see that air cargo is kind of on a different trajectory, or especially construction to support it. And this is brought out in a New York Times article. Air cargo construction is booming thanks to Amazon. And they provide some interesting examples. For example, at Cincinnati Northern Kentucky International Airport, where Amazon Air is building a sorting center. This is just shy of 800,000 square feet of sorting center. It even includes a 7-level parking garage. This all to accommodate some 20 aircraft. And that's expected to open in the fall. But that's only part of Amazon's $1.5 billion commitment to a 3 million square foot air cargo hub at Cincinnati. We see Amazon Air's air transport network. They have more than 70 aircraft now, hundreds of daily flights, according to the New York Times. And just last week, Amazon announced they were going to purchase 11 Boeing 767-300 aircraft, part of a fleet expansion. And they're not alone. FedEx is up. They handled an average of 6.2 million air packages a day. That's a day, 6.2 million in 2020, and that's up 48% compared to 2016, so a few years ago. And they just opened a $290 million project at Ontario International Airport, Southern California. So we see, I mean, this is kind of not surprising with people buying more online, you know, the need for fast delivery, package delivery from these kinds of carriers makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, you'd sort of hate to call it a bright spot. What I wonder is how permanent it is. You know, what do you guys think? Do you think that culture has shifted to the point where going to brick and mortar stores is permanently reduced?
Well, e-commerce transaction activities, you know, retail sales volume and transactions have accelerated by 3 years in the past few months, in the past year or less. And what's interesting is the acceleration has been as rapid outside the U.S. As it has been here within the U.S. And that's important to note because in many other countries, they were not as they had not embraced e-commerce with quite the same zeal as we have in the States. In some cases, they were close, but in other areas, not so much. You know, I do think air cargo and logistics are a bright spot because they're adding aircraft. In some cases, they may be able to hire some of the pilots or other employees who were laid off by passenger carriers. They're acquiring the unneeded aircraft. As you mentioned, the 767s Amazon is acquiring from Delta and from WestJet. Amazon is propping up Sun Country, a small budget airline based in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And Sun Country has begun operating all freighter 737 aircraft on behalf of Amazon Prime. So, you know, you look at this and you look at also operators like DHL and others outside the U.S., and it is amazing to see how that industry has adapted. What's really a shame is that Boeing didn't have its Everett facility somewhere in the middle of the country, because as they downsized building wide-body jets there, if it were in the middle of the country, Amazon would probably snap up that manufacturing building and say, hey, we'll use that as a distribution warehouse.
Sure. Yeah. And you mentioned DHL. They've ordered 8 more Boeing 777 freighters.
Atlas, I think, Atlas or somebody just ordered some 747-8 freighters.
Right. That was Atlas. They ordered, I think, 4 of them, which are reportedly to be the last 4 that Boeing builds. which is kind of
interesting. Until Atlas orders another four.
Yes, which I'm sure Boeing would love to accommodate.
Which is actually kind of interesting that they're buying, because a lot of Amazon Prime has been shipping on Atlas in the past, but now as Amazon is starting to buy their own fleet, which they, of course, we just talked earlier about how initially they're buying 11, but I think a vice president said they could have as many as 80 within a year or two. I can't remember the exact time frame. I would imagine that Atlas is losing some of that to Amazon business, and yet they still see enough growth to buy 747. So that tells you there's still a lot of growth going on in cargo.
And what's also interesting is they're buying these planes new, as opposed to, you know, buying up some of the passenger 747-400s that have been grounded by airlines around the world, or even maybe some of their cargo 747-400s that may have existed. So they're doing that. And of course, what we're not seeing anybody buy are the A380s that have been grounded.
Right. Yes. Right. Yeah, I wonder if that's a permanent situation, or if that will change. I don't know, but
well, and I actually just saw an article from that said half of the Emirates A380 fleet will never fly again. I believe that was the headline that I saw,
which would be about a quarter of the total fleet. Then, if it's half of the, I think if I could go back in time 12 months, I think my investment strategy would be companies that produce cardboard and plexiglass. I think those two things would have been the good plays 12 months ago. All right. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. And David, I understand that there is an Italian aircraft carrier coming to the States.
Actually, this is kind of a sequel. We already had the Royal Navy in town at Norfolk with the new Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier to work with the United States Marine Corps and work up their F-35Bs. That was successful, so successful, the Italians are bringing over their aircraft carrier to work over with their F-35Bs with the United States Marine Corps. What makes this interesting is the ability of these right now, or on the first deployment with the Queen Elizabeth, the U.S. Marines sent a squadron aboard the Queen Elizabeth, as well as the Royal Air Force, Royal Navy F-35 squadron. So we had two nations operating off of one aircraft carrier. The same thing will probably go with the Italians. So we'll have ways to cross deck, which we haven't been doing in years, which gives us all new opportunities. And eventually, I'm sure that maybe we'll even see Japan send their aircraft carriers or their aircraft cruisers over to maybe the Pacific, the San Diego port of call, to work up with the U.S. Marines, since they're the baseline for amphibious operations or at-sea operations with the B, which is the STOVL, short takeoff and vertical landing. The Italian carrier has gone through major upgrades to support the F-35B. It was originally used the AV-8B as its primary aircraft, as well as helicopters. Well, now it's been reinforced and restructured to accommodate and support the F-35B. So we'll have a couple of months where we'll have an Italian aircraft carrier sailing out of a U.S. port until workups are finally done, and then it'll head back to the Med.
And so the Italian Navy has ordered 15 F-35Bs, and I guess the Italian Air Force has ordered the same number of Bs, but also 60 of the F-35As, the A model. But when that carrier goes back to Italy, it's not going to go back with F-35s on its deck, correct? The F-35s will be delivered to Italy later?
Well, actually, Italy is a production country for final production. So Italy is producing their own F-35s, the F-35As and F-35Bs. So yeah, that aircraft carrier will probably go back with an empty deck, or there will be some it might come across with some Italian F-35Bs, which are available. But they will be using the Marine Corps aircraft as well to work up the aircraft carrier. It's not just the pilots learning to land on the aircraft carrier. It's all of the crews on how to operate the aircraft at sea. You've got all the maintenance crews as well as the deck handling. And so all of the whole workup of getting the new aircraft familiarized with the aircraft carrier.
Now, I think I know the answer to this question, David, but when this aircraft carrier is in Virginia, is there any chance we can go see it?
Don't see why not. It'll be in Norfolk Harbor. So if you ever want, I highly recommend the boat tour of the Norfolk, where they take you up and down the river, and you can see all the aircraft carriers that are in port. And you never know if the universe favors us and we're all immune and or wearing masks, maybe the Italian Navy will have an open house and allow us to go aboard in an open house, which would really be kind of cool.
So the carrier is supposed to arrive in mid-February, I think. And how long is it there? 3 months, is that right?
Yes. So that's May, June, is more February, March, April. So maybe late April we can start planning a trip where we'll get a hold of the Italian Navy and maybe we can go out on a cruise.
Outstanding. All right. We have one other military story. This came from our friend Steve Vischer, and he covered a story on the news channel that he works for sometimes. This is Apache chosen as armed helicopter replacement, and the Defense Department announced it's going to replace the Army's fleet of Tiger ARHs with Apache AH-64E Apache Guardians. David, what are those two aircraft like, those two choppers like?
Well, the Tiger ARH was a Eurocopter, and to be honest, the Australians have not necessarily been fond of it since they've purchased them. They've had a lot of problems. They had a crash, and they've been looking to replace them. The AH-64E Apache Guardian is the standard for Western countries for an attack helicopter. It's the export version and a less complex, more advanced version of the Longbow Apache, the AH-64D, that's in service with multiple countries and pretty much is the standard for a attack helicopter. So the AH, they'll go away rapidly, and there'll be a lot of commonality between Australia and its veritable allies like Japan, the United States, South Korea, all of which have Apache squadrons. So it's probably a good move for Australia, and maybe even New Zealand might get some. So that would be a good commonality and opportunity for Australia, and a good win for, believe it or not, Boeing. I know that's kind of hard to believe, but yes, this is technically a Boeing product, though you'll never hear me say that. It's a Hughes product. It's a win for Boeing, and Boeing's got a good relationship with Australia as far as defense goes. So congratulations to Australia. It'll be interesting to see them come along online, and the brown, green, and black Australian camouflage is going to look really good on an Apache. So,
okay. All right. Well, Steve sent along a really short little clip from the news channel. So let's listen to that.
Defence Minister Linda Reynolds has made the announcement in Canberra, saying the decision to purchase 29 AH-64E Apache helicopters from the United States will bolster the nation's armed reconnaissance force and provide significant deterrence capability. The aircraft will replace the current fleet of Eurocopter Tiger attack helicopters, and Kath Ziesing from Australian Defence Magazine says the purchase was anticipated by many in the industry.
The purchase of the Apaches announced this morning is probably the worst kept secret in Canberra, but it is a welcome announcement from government nonetheless.
The new aircraft are set to enter service in 2025. Steve Vischer, Air News.
Wow, Steve sounds like a pro, doesn't he?
Always does.
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Steve. All right. Just quickly, Launchpad Merzari sent us sort of a list of different aviation events that are postponed or moved or changed or canceled or somehow affected by COVID-19. The Land Sport Aviation Showcase in Florida that was originally planned for November 12th through 14th last year, 2020. It was postponed until January this year, 2021, but it's been delayed again until November later this year, 2021. Also, the National Warbird Operator Conference that was originally scheduled for February, this February 2021, has been postponed to February next year, the 24th through 27th, February 2022. Same venue, the Omni Corpus Christi Hotel in Corpus Christi, Texas. Another interesting change as a result of the pandemic is Sierra Nevada Corporation announced that the first Dream Chaser civilian space plane mission to the International Space Station has been postponed to 2022. Now, it starts out as an uncrewed cargo mission to the ISS, and I guess they're scheduled to operate or conduct at least six of those under a commercial resupply services contract with NASA. And if you're not familiar with this Dream Chaser, it looks like a mini space shuttle. It can carry up to 5,500 kilograms to low Earth orbit. And then finally, in this vein, from AOPA Live this week, AOPA announced that the fifth annual Bob Hoover Trophy Awards Ceremony will be virtual and live online this year. The trophy goes to Bert Rutan. You'll be able to watch that February 3rd, 2021 at 8 p.m. Eastern, and we'll have a link in the show notes where you can watch that. They're not only going to present the Hoover Trophy to Bert Rutan, but they're also going to present the inaugural Brigadier General Charles E. McGee Aviation Inspiration Award. That's going to be presented to General McGee himself. And then he'll make the first presentation of this award to a young military aviator and aviation leader, Kenyatta Ruffin. So that's very exciting.
Max, reading that list took me back to my childhood. As you were reading it, I kind of was reminiscing about growing up in the icebox of Pennsylvania, which is the extreme northern part of the state where it gets really cold. And on certain mornings, we'd all have the radio turned on and we'd be listening to everything that was closed because of snow, waiting to hear, is our school closed? And of course, you know, it was just one of those moments where you were just hoping as they read, you know, 2, 3, 4 minutes of closing. It's like, tell us about the school.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I remember that too.
And my school always seemed to be 2 hours late.
Not closed, just late. Henry, are you missing the events this year, the conferences, the places where you would go, the things that you would do as a result of all this?
Yeah, I mean, I travel, or normally would travel, a great deal for work, and conferences are indeed a part of it. Sometimes it's a company event that's just for their employees or their invited guests, but there are also conferences like the World Aviation Festival in London that I've been involved with for several years, and a few others. IATA has an event that I've attended for a while on the air distribution and retailing side, and you know, there are a handful of those kinds of events that I do miss attended. You know, and it's as much because of the ability to talk to people outside of the formal sessions. It's the, you know, happenstance meeting with somebody. It's the sidebar conversations that you are able to have with people. And while the virtual meetings have certainly been productive, I'd say that from my standpoint, they get me 70 to 80% of the of what I need and value from attending a conference. Plus, honestly, it's nice to get out of the house.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we're recording this on Zoom right now because of some technical difficulties we couldn't get sorted out before we started recording. And so we ended up on Zoom. And I think you mentioned as we were going through all that, Henry, that you've been spending a lot of time on Zoom over the months. But I agree with you. I think that you can have productive conversations, virtual meetings, but in the end, there is nothing like face-to-face. So I think the people who indicate their belief that we may never return to the in-person conferences and events like that, I don't think that's going to pan out. I think people need to physically get together.
I agree with you. Look, I've read many of the same articles you guys have probably read and have heard people like Bill Gates say half of business travel will come back. The head of a company in India said that they closed billions of dollars of business through virtual meeting platforms and so on. You know what? This is one case, perhaps the only time in my life where I think I'm going to be right and Bill Gates is going to be wrong. we do a monthly survey with corporate travel managers. We've got more than 100 in our panel. And depending on the month, we get usually in the low 60s to sometimes more than 80 responding to the monthly survey. And at this point, our most recent survey was in December. We are just getting the January survey into the field because of the holiday. We sent it out a little later than we normally do. And as of January, only 7% said that they don't expect to return at all to their pre-COVID levels of spending and business travel activity. 7% are definitive. But 30% are not sure when they will return. And that's a great degree of uncertainty. Now, I don't think all 30% will go back to what they did, but I certainly don't think that all 30% aren't going to go back either. Mm. I think a lot depends on the type of travel you do for the kind of business a company is in. And what your work is. Again, based on the research that we do with the travel managers and in talking with executives, we believe that business travel will return in phases, if you will. The first phase will consist of externally focused travel that's associated with bringing in revenue, sales calls, meetings with clients, business development, things like that. The next wave is going to be internal travel. So that's department meetings, that's an all hands or something like that, perhaps partners at a consulting firm or another business coming together to plan their annual business meetings. Because that is entirely, the cost for that is entirely borne by the business, they're going to be very careful about spending that money if there's no revenue associated with it. Right now, we think convention and meeting related spending comes in last. And that's not because people don't want to go to these conferences. It's because they want to make sure nobody gets sick doing it. Mm. And so again, until we get a lot of people vaccinated, I think the sales departments and in fact, companies, corporate security and legal officers and HR are going to weigh in saying, we've got to be more careful about these conventions or conferences and what we do, how many people we send out and so on. So that's how we see it coming back. Again, based on the research that we've done right now, the travel managers expect to be back to maybe 20 to 25% of pre-COVID levels of business travel spending this year. Next year will probably jump up much more rapidly. And there, again, as I said a few moments ago, there is a chance that the vaccines do get distributed and things go better than expected. We could see that business travel recovery continue at a faster than expected pace. And that would be great.
Yeah, it would.
Henry, how does that compare to like 2008 when we had the recession and the recovery that came out of that? Did business sort of follow the same pattern or?
Well, here's the thing we have to remember that after 9/11, during the 2008-2010 recession, business travel didn't stop. Air travel demand didn't plunge by 96% as we saw it happen at the beginning of COVID. It just declined. And so, yes, we also heard the same thing. In fact, I've been an analyst now for 20 years. I started at Forrester in January 2000. And
Every year we would hear as some major new technology innovation came out, this is the death of business travel. Business travel has been pronounced dead and buried more often than Cher has done farewell tours. And so, you know, what I will say is this, we certainly are going to see a different type of recovery for business travel now compared to even 2008, 2010, because platforms like Zoom are available. And in many cases, they're free. Skype, all sorts of tools are available. Internet access is better. High-speed internet access is better in many places. It's not entirely perfect. There's still a great number of countries. Even here in the US, we've got a digital divide. But, you know, we certainly know that there are some meetings, some interactions that used to take place that we're going to look at and say, you know what, especially if business travel policies aren't great, we're going to forego that, and at least for a while. So, you know, I do think that the business travel recovery will exist. I think we do come back to better than 90% or so of where we were. But look, if you're a United Airlines or a British Airways or a Cathay Pacific or any other airline, Emirates, where you have built your business with a substantial emphasis on people who fly in the pointy part of the plane, then this is going to be a challenge for you. You're going to have to rethink once things stabilize, what is your business strategy? How do you make your premium cabins more accessible from a pricing standpoint to people who don't have business expense accounts to bill to? Or, you know, even if they do, where their companies may change their policies, as a lot intend to, in terms of restricting access to the premium cabin, the big seats, as we like to call it.
Well, there's one thing I hope doesn't go back to normal completely after the pandemic, and that's the work at home trend. I would hate to see all of those people start commuting back again because the traffic is fantastic. Yeah. It is nice. It is nice not to have those massive traffic jams that we see here in the metro areas in the past. So I'm just hoping some of those people will still work at home.
Well, they will. And what's really interesting is at the beginning of this, everyone's like, oh, we're going to work from home forever. And companies like Twitter and several others have said people can work from home indefinitely. And that's great. But we've all heard, including people like Scott Kirby, CEO of United, say the first time a company loses a sale to a competitor, it's putting its people back out on the road. And what's very interesting about the whole culture thing is that a lot of people, including people who are newer in their careers, miss being in the office, not because they want to be in gray or beige cubicles and, you know, dull office spaces, but from the social aspect and importantly from the face time they get with their bosses, their mentors and others. And just like we can have that highly beneficial casual conversation with someone in, you know, at a conference, you have that at work. I live in San Francisco, and what's interesting here is that there was a plan proposed by a metropolitan transportation group for large companies to mandate that their employees work from home at least three days a week. And the companies that objected to it most strenuously were the technology companies like Google and other large tech firms that said, no, we want to have the flexibility to control when we bring people back, how we bring them back, how many days in the week they are in the office. And they're hearing from their employees, not everybody has the home space to work from home full time, the family structure. You know, how many of us have had what I call the BBC moment since this started of kids walking in or pets barking or neighbors doing something or whatever while we're on what, you know, is supposed to be an important business call. So I think there are a lot of people who want to get back to the office. I think there are a lot of people, spouses and partners, who want them to go back to the office too.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, assuming they're still together after.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting point. For a different show.
Henry, while we have you here, I wanted to ask you about the 737 MAX and the public perception of that aircraft, of Boeing, of the FAA, the regulators. How is that affecting people's perception, people's confidence in the safety of air travel?
Well, you know, we did some research last in 2019 on passenger attitudes towards the 737 MAX and Boeing. And as you would expect, this was research we fielded in May of 2019. The attitudes were highly negative. What was amazing was to look at people's impression, the change in their perception towards Boeing itself. Their attitudes towards Boeing went from Boeing basically being a big, you know, anonymous great company, one they'd heard of, but just viewed as reliable, safe, and everything, but just kind of out there, you know, existing, to a highly negative opinion of the company, which really shocked me as the analyst. And in a way, that's good, because when you're doing research, you really don't want to know the answer when you're fielding the study. And as you would expect, also in the aftermath of two terrible plane crashes and a grounding, very few people said they would get on the plane. Roughly 14% said at the time that they would want to fly a 737 MAX within 6 months of its return to service. And a little more than 20% or so said they would fly it in a year or so after going back. And people said that they would pay more to fly other airlines or airlines that operated other aircraft, even if it meant less convenient schedule or connection or stop on the way or something like that. Now, I will also tell you that I don't believe the reaction would have been as great, but that was sentiment. One of the greatest things that could have happened to Boeing, to its 737 MAX customers, and to the plane itself is COVID, because for the past year or so, COVID has provided this smokescreen of big news that has obliterated the challenges of the 737 MAX. And it's reduced demand for travel. It has affected people's willingness to get on any airplane going anywhere. So, you know, it's great that the 737 MAX has been recertified. In fact, today, the day we're recording this interview, Canada just approved the MAX for return to service there. So it's great that we're seeing the plane going back to, into the skies. I think we will see negative reaction be much less than it is. I think a lot of people will get on the plane and will shrug their shoulders when they find out it's a MAX. We know from our research that roughly half of travelers take a look at the type of airplane that they're supposed to be on when they're booking a flight. But most of the time, that is to look at, you know, does it have Wi-Fi? Does it have in-seat power? Things like that. You know, except for us av geeks, very few people are going to say, oh, I'm going to take, you know, this flight because it's an A320 versus a 737. They might change if it's a regional jet versus a mainline plane, or if it's a wide body plane versus single aisle. There will be some people who avoid the 737 MAX, but I think that that curve falls dramatically, especially if the plane does, you know, performs as it should, safely, reliably, all of that. If all goes well over the next 3 months, maybe 6 months with the 737 MAX, by the time summer 2022 travel begins, I think most people will view it as just another airplane.
Well, and I think the key strategy, which the airlines probably know, is when they go pricing these aircraft, if the 737 MAX ticket is priced $1 lower than all the other tickets, people will flock to that particular ticket. So absolutely. I agree with you. I think in a very short period of time, people are going to go, well, you know, they did a lot of work. It's probably safe, or you know, they've just kind of forgotten about the whole thing.
Right. But I think let's look at what just happened a few days ago with the terrible crash in Indonesia. Yeah. That was a 737-500. And I cannot tell you how many reporters who called me about it wanted, you know, to ask the question, is this the same plane as the MAX? Now, even if they knew the answer, they wanted the confirmation from an outside source. But this is an issue, unfortunately, with the 737 family. But I think it quickly was pointed out that these planes are cousins, if you will, rather than, you know, they're, and in fact, of course, we know the 737-500 is part of the original classic series and several generations removed from the MAX.
Yeah. And in fact, I think all of the news reports that I read specifically pointed out that this was different than the Mac. So it's interesting that not only were the journalists asking the question, but they were also providing that information to the to the audience.
Right, but in the days after, I think right after American or shortly before American's first 737 Max went back into service on December 29th, there was an incident with an Air Canada Max doing a test flight where one of the engines went out, if I'm remembering it correctly, and that was big news. So I think even a broken coffee maker on a 737 Max is going to be news, unfortunately, because of the way things work, but. If there are no incidents with the plane, and I think Boeing and the safety regulators have taken the right steps of requiring simulator training and new checklists and giving the pilots more control over the aircraft and so on, I think the 737 MAX is poised to operate well. And let's just look at the DC-10. You know, when the DC-10 was grounded, granted it was only 38 days or so, but there were a lot of people who said, oh, I'll never fly a DC-10. And look, I worked for TWA in the mid-80s, and we still had a little bit of a benefit by advertising we flew L-1011s at the time. And that was years after the DC-10 had crashed and was grounded.
Henry, you were wearing diapers back then. Why are you lying like that?
Thank you. Child labor. Yeah. But Carl Icahn wanted cheap labor. But here's the interesting thing. The DC-10, of course, went on to have a terrific career. And when it was retired a few years ago, people were crying, saying it was the best airplane ever built. And it was my favorite airplane. And, you know, there'll never be another one like it. And mark my words, you know, when in 50 years or maybe 100 years, when the last 737 MAX is retired, there will be av geeks there saying that was the best airplane Boeing ever made and there will never be anything like it again and yada yada. So, you know, we as people are weird, but I think that the, you know, I certainly hope the MAX goes on to serve its airline customers, and we as the traveling public, as well as the crews who operate it, well.
I just want to follow back up on the most recent crash. A couple of things about that. One, it seems to have vanished from the news very, very quickly. And I don't know if that's because there were only 60-some people on board versus, you know, 150 with some of the MAX crashes, or because it's not the MAX and therefore, you know, it seemed like it was not connected in any way with prior crashes. What did seem odd about it is that the crew seemed to have lost communications shortly after takeoff. And then, of course, it kind of fell from the sky, you know, soon after that. But it landed in very shallow water. So I think they're going to find out, you know, what that is. But it's fascinating to me that it just didn't get all that much attention.
Well, look, it got some attention at the beginning. It's Indonesia. There was some attention because of the safety problems there that exist, unfortunately. But you're right. It wasn't a MAX. And I think people realized, okay, this is a tragedy. 62 lives were lost. We can't ignore that. But I think a lot of people, including me, told the reporters, we can't prejudge this. We don't know what happened. We need to wait. The responsible thing is to wait until the flight data recorders have been recovered and the flight voice recorders and the safety boards do their reviews. I mean, it's not an MH370 where you had a 777 disappearing, ever to be found again. You don't have that mystery out there. And frankly, you had far bigger news stories taking place at the time. You had the U.S. presidential election and all the noise around that. We've got COVID. In Europe, there's Brexit. And undoubtedly, there are other stories elsewhere. In Indonesia, this certainly may be a larger story, and perhaps even within Asia, than it is here in the U.S. or perhaps in other parts of the world.
All right, let's do a little What's Up with the Geeks. Max Trescott, I saw a new episode of your podcast hit my podcast app today. Or maybe it was yesterday. I'm not sure. Recently.
depends what time you looked at it, because it went up very late last night.
Okay.
But yes, I've been dropping new episodes on Mondays, so that they're available for the commute for those people who are out there commuting. And 174, which just dropped on Monday, included an interesting interview, Civil Air Patrol. Two gentlemen flew a flight delivering vaccine. So it's one of only one or two general aviation flights that have occurred delivering vaccine, and that was in a Gippsland GA-8. So most of the Civil Air Patrol planes are 172s and 182s, but they do have a few of the large GA-8s. And so they employ this for a five-day mission to deliver vaccine to remote areas in Wisconsin and Michigan. Fascinating interview. So if you're interested in hearing about how Civil Air Patrol and GA has been involved with Operation Warp Speed, check out episode 174, Aviation News Talk.
Very good. Just want to touch on a listener mail we received from Robert. Robert wrote in and said he's a big fan of the show. He says, I've been listening for a couple of years now. You guys are one of my biggest inspirations about aviation and learning to fly, which I did 2 years ago. I got my private pilot license on my 40th birthday. Oh, congratulations, Robert, on that. He says, I still can't believe it. I've been trying to meet you guys at one of these air shows the past few years, but unfortunately it has not happened yet. Hopefully 2021, fingers crossed. He says, actually, I did meet Max West in 2019 at the AOPA Tullahoma, Tennessee fly-in. He says, it was so easy to recognize him. Who would take a picture at 7:30 in the morning of a Cirrus Vision jet?
Well, that's the best time to take pictures, early in the morning there when you get that that sun just right. Yes, I often go out because otherwise the crowds show up soon after that, and I'm always looking for photos that I can use for different things. And I think that photo most likely got used in my my new book, which we'll be talking about here in a month or so.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. Also, Robert says he wanted to say something about last week's episode. He's also a drone pilot. He says, I have two drones I'm using for a videography business. He's got a DJI Phantom 2 Pro and a Mavic Air 2, which has the ADS-B feature. He said, which I love because it easily allows me on my phone, or at least easily shows me on my phone, the air traffic around me. A very helpful feature I wish they put in every drone. You guys were talking about these things, talking about all these things, about remote ID and such, which I think is going to be a very good thing. I remember when I was doing my training at St. Augustine Airport in Florida, there were so many drones around, and a couple of times they were very close to being a crash. So the remote ID definitely is going to make a lot safer sky. He says, as you guys were talking about the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth connection, it's actually, I think, he says, it's very simple. The remote control you are using with the drone, it connects your phone with a cable. That's how you are connected through the internet, through your phone, not the drone itself connected to the internet, he says. The drone connects to the remote control with 2.4 gigahertz frequency. The app you are using is able to show the location of the drone on the map and also records your flight path. So definitely you have to have data service on your phone to be able to get the location of your drone. He says, one more thing, the 737 MAX, I like this. He says, I know you guys do not want to talk about it anymore, but you will anyway. Guess what? He's right. He said, I wanted to share the episodes of Stuck Mike Avcast. They had a five-part special series of detailed analysis of the 737 MAX with Ben Bowman, Justin Ash, and Carl Valeri. They were talking about every detail of the 737 MAX accidents, which led to that, the whole industry, pilot training, the whole picture, which most people did not even hear. He said, have you guys known about Lion Air Flight 43. That was the flight 30 days before Lion Air 610. The same plane had the exact problem, only different, it did not crash. So Robert says, highly recommend listening to those episodes. You will see a different picture of the 737 MAX. He said, I definitely did.
So yeah, the Stuck Mike Avcast should definitely be on your radar screen. It's a great show. Carl Valeri and the gang do an amazing job. And we'll put in the show notes links to those five episodes, those five parts of the series that they did on the 737 MAX. And I thank Robert for pointing that out. All right. With that, I think we're close to wrapping this up. Henry, we want to thank you for coming on the show. Is there anything going on with Atmosphere that A, is interesting, and B, you can reveal?
Well, yeah. I mean, so I shared some of the stuff that we do with the corporate travel managers. I'll say this. For those of us who have been stuck at home and can't wait to get out traveling again, you're part of 80% or more of the world. We do consumer research in more than a dozen countries. And in every country we surveyed, since starting in Q2 of last year, we ask people to agree or disagree with a variety of statements, including, I can't wait to start traveling again. In the U.S., 84% of people agree with that. You know, we very much love traveling. There are a lot of people for whom travel is a big part of their own identities. We feel it makes us more interesting people, which frankly, I think it does. And we recognize the good that comes of traveling and the fun that occurs, even if it's a business trip. And so I do think we're going to be traveling again. And so, by the way, if you do get one of our research studies, if you're either in business or one of the panels we use, please take it.
Very good. And of course, we can find Atmosphere Research at atmosphereresearch.com.
We have a terrible website. It's like the cobbler's kid who has the worst shoes. It's atmosphereresearch.com.
Very good. All right. And Henry, you're active on social media.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. You can reach me on Twitter. The handle there is at H Hartevelt. Hartevelt is spelled H-A-R-T as in Tom, E-V as in Victory, E-L-D-T. I'm also on LinkedIn. You can find me there at Henry Hartevelt.
Terrific. And of course, we'll have links to both of those in the show notes, as always. So again, Henry, thanks so much. It's always great to get your perspective on things. I mean, you definitely have the big picture, but at a detailed level. So it's a nice combination. All right, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/637. Email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And Mr. Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter, on Facebook. You can find me at the American Helicopter Museum now that we're open again.
So you're open again.
Back. We are open. So on Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays from noon to 5, where the museum is open and starting to get people back. So that's good news. And of course, you can find me on our Slack listener team. You do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll send you an invite. You can join the conversation there. And of course, you can find me on Fridays with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones on the UAV Digest.
Good. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, I have just figured out why Henry wants to get back to traveling again. I'm sure he's looking at a potential new gig in the Dos Equis commercial. I'm sure he wants to be the most interesting man in the world.
That will never happen. I'm definitely so many light years away from that, but thank you.
Well, okay. I just figured, you know, that was it. Travel makes us more interesting.
But he makes a mean cocktail.
Yeah.
Ah. Oh, yeah. My Friday Av Geek cocktails. I have a very extensive collection of vintage airline glasses, the majority of which were my dad, as he used to say, borrowed on a permanent basis from airlines. And they go back. There's one that one of my grandfathers have. They go back to the 1940s.
Wow.
And are mostly 1940s through 70s.
Well, so we could say actually you have the most interesting airline glass collection
in the world. That I will take. I will accept that.
Sounds good. And folks can find me at all the usual places. If you go out to aviationnewstalk.com, just click on contact. You can send me an email. And of course, check us out each week wherever you get your podcast for Aviation News Talk, which focuses on general aviation.
Excellent. And you can find me at 30,000feet.com. Spelled out, all words, no spaces. And you can find links there to all the podcasts and social media places where I hang out. So we'll ask that all of you please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.